There's really no end to the things we can find to disagree about in American society, and there are some very basic divisions underlying our squabbling. Religion is certainly among those. Some of us are religious, some of us are not, but nearly all of us consider ourselves moral people, which raises the question for the religious people about how we can be moral without a belief in a higher power. Our guest this hour lives a secular life and writes and speaks about how that life is lived. Phil Zuckerman is professor of sociology at Pitzer College and the founding chair of the nation's first secular studies program. He blogs for Psychology Today and the Huffington Post and is the author of several books, including Living the Secular Life and Faith No More. This is a return visit for Phil. He joined us in February 2011 to talk about society without God. So, Phil Zuckerman, good to see you back on the Jefferson Exchange.
So glad to be back. Thank you.
Tell us about how the focus formed in your life. This is kind of like the opposite of waking up one morning and saying, Mom, Dad, I want to go to seminary.
Oh, that's true. You know, I did grow up in a pretty secular part of the world. I grew up in the 70s and 80s in Southern California near Santa Monica. Not a lot of religion. Didn't know kids. Nobody went to church on Sunday mornings. Didn't ever see anybody praying around the dinner table. I never had teachers talk about their missionary trips to Mexico or whatnot. So religion really was not a big part of my life. I knew it was out there, but out there was the key word. And it was really only when I was 15, I had my first serious girlfriend. She was the daughter of a non-denominational evangelical fire and brimstone preacher who had come out from Kansas or Oklahoma. I can't remember what. And, you know, it was like, what? You know, and I remember going to church with them and being like, wait, this is freaky. This is weird. I also see there's a lot of community here, so I could see what they were getting out of it. But I was sort of fixated on religion, and I spent a long time studying it, trying to understand it, and try to figure it out. And there's a lot there. If you want to study religion, you got a lifetime full of stuff to study. But as I continued with my studies and got a bit older, I realized, wait a minute, there's tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people who live without religion, and they're doing great. They're doing fine. They're loving, they're productive, they're creative, they're thoughtful, they're moral, they're ethical, and we're not talking about them. How does that work? How does that function? And that's how I sort of got into secular studies. So, and I guess if I stop and think about it, it was actually during the Bush era that the fire really got lit under my butt, because I remember when George W. Bush won, or he didn't really win. He of course lost the votes, but somehow because of the shenanigans in Florida, he became our president. And I remember the spin was, well, it was those values voters that really came out in droves. And I was like, values? You mean, wait, being anti-gay marriage is a value? To me, that's immoral, unethical, and mean-spirited. So I was like, wait a minute. Why do they have this notion that the people that are, I think, most unethical are somehow have values? And I really wanted to explore that and show how secular culture actually is rife with values. So.
But as you pointed out, when you're studying religion, I mean, if you do if you become a student of comparative religions or something, it's really easy to delve deep into Islam and the branches of that, and Christianity and the branches of that, and different forms of Judaism. So there's lots of there. In secular studies, are you studying an absence?
That's a great question. So I would say there's two ways. Well, there's about three ways to answer that. On the one hand, it is true that secularity is characterized by an absence of something. For example, I come from Jewish stock. But I'm secular. So if you look at me, I am missing a yarmulke. That is absent from my head. So you could say, well, what am I studying here? A yarmulke-less head, you know? If I were a Mormon and I gave it up, I would no longer be wearing my sacred undergarments. So yes, there is a sort of loss of something or a lack of something. On the other hand, secularity is also based on positive precepts, values. I'll just give you some examples. Sort of, you could talk about secularity as encompassing a naturalistic worldview, a belief in evidence-based claims, belief in the scientific method as the best way to understand the physical world. We believe in a morality based on empathy. So there are actually many values and virtues that characterize and are typified by secular people. And so what we are studying, I guess you could say, is several things. Number one, at the sociological level, we would like to study, you know, who is secular? Who tends to be non-religious? Who are they? Why are they non-religious? How are they different from religious people, psychologically, sociologically, politically? On the other hand, there's the whole political secularism realm, church-state issues, whether you're studying laïcité in France, whether you're studying the current crisis in Turkey. India right now is debating what secularism means to their national identity. So there's secular movements have progressive values, sometimes regressive in the case of the former Soviet Union. So there's a whole realm of politics. And finally, there's the philosophical realm where we're studying skepticism, rationalism, materialism, existentialism. So there is a lot there. And just the variety of what it means to be secular. There's so many different versions. There's atheists, agnostics, skeptics, humanists, apatheists, people that are just different, don't give it a thought. And we're really just scratching the surface. We haven't typologized secularity to the degree that we've typologized religiosity. So it's a new field, and we've got a lot of digging to do to excavate this culture.
Have you had many students enroll in the secular studies program at Pitzer College, and what kinds of things do they want to go on to do after college?
Mm-hmm. So it's a new program. It's only been around for a few years, and we're a small college. Pitzer College has 900 students. We're a small liberal arts college. We're part of the Claremont Colleges, which is a larger consortium, but only Pitzer students can major in secular studies. So we've literally had a handful. We've had about 3 or 4 students who actually major in it. However, our classes are exploding. So our course enrollments are very, very popular. So clearly, students want to take 1 or 2 or 3 classes looking at either the history of secularism or church-state debates or philosophical skepticism and so on and so forth. So, but you know, to major in it is a bit tricky, and I can talk about we're hoping that our students go on to either law, public policy, education, social activism, and we've had some real great successes that I can talk about if you like. Monica Miller is one of our best grads.
Okay, Monica Miller. We'll hold it there and come back and talk about her when we come back from a break. We're talking to Phil Zuckerman about secular versus religious morality. He'll be talking in Ashland tonight at the Rogue Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, 7 to 9, about secular versus religious morality in the age of Trump. And you can join the conversation here on The Exchange when we return in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Phil Zuckerman. He's professor of sociology at Pitzer College, the founding chair of the nation's first secular studies program. He is all about secularity, blogs about it, he writes books about it, and he's giving a talk tonight in Ashland at 7 o'clock at the Rogue Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Called Secular versus Religious Morality in the Age of Trump. You can join the discussion. There's obviously a lot of meaty discussion topics right there. 800-838-3760 to join us here on the program by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I guess I should pause for a moment and ask about the distinction between secular, if there is one, between secular and non-religious. I mean, can you believe in God but not have God be a driving force in your life? Can you be – well, you know, you hear about secular Jews or secular Catholics and things like that.
You bet. I like to use the 3 B's as the best way to understand this: belief, behavior, and belonging as ways to get at the kind of religious secular continuum. And it is best to think of it as a continuum and not an either or, you know. So if you think about it, you know, either you have supernatural beliefs or you don't, or you have some supernatural beliefs but not others. And most religious people have some type of supernatural beliefs, either in gods or goddesses or other realms or spirits or whatnot. So you got the belief level, the behavior level. That's just what you actually do. Do you pray? Do you fast? Do you celebrate? Do you congregate? Do you circumcise? Do you cut your forehead? I mean, those are the behaviors in relation to those beliefs. And finally, belonging just gets at the kind of identity level. How do you identify? And so what I would say is not everybody is religious along all 3 B's. For some people, it's about belief. For some people, it has nothing to do with belief, but more about belonging. So you're secular Jews who will identify with a Jewish community, but maybe not believe in the actual beliefs. A lot of cultural Catholics might fall into that camp. So what I would argue is if you look at these 3 levels, belief, behavior, belonging, and you look at it maybe as a 10-point scale, 1 to 10, well, religious people would lean towards one end of the spectrum on these 3 B's to certain degrees. Secular people would lean towards the other end of the spectrum. So, you know, very few of us are completely religious in all aspects, you know, having nothing but supernatural beliefs, doing nothing but religious activities, and identifying in no other way than being religious. Very few of us would be there. And very few of us are just completely secular, having no supernatural beliefs, engaging in no religious behaviors, and not identifying in any sense with anything religious. But you know, more people are leaning towards the secular end of the spectrum than the religious end right now. So we are seeing a kind of secularizing trend. Fewer people identifying as religious, people's religious beliefs being a bit watered down than what they used to be, and people doing fewer people attending church and engaging in religious rituals. So we are seeing people leaning more towards the secular end of the spectrum than the religious end.
But it's interesting because the people who proclaim a belief in God, when pollsters ask them, that's a much higher number than the people who actually talk about going to church, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Weekly church attendance has been going down steadily for decades, and very, you know, only a minority of Americans go to church every week. It's probably somewhere between 25% and 33% who do that. But when asked about belief in God, Americans rank pretty darn high, especially compared to other Western industrialized democracies. So what you'll find is if people are just asked if they believe in God, I'm going to say it's going to be somewhere between 75% and 80%. Sometimes they ask the question, do you believe in God or a higher power? And that always stacks the deck in their favor. Then, you know, you're getting up to 85%, 90%. So it depends how the question is worded. But, you know, it also depends how do people, you know, define God. It's certainly not, for some people, it is the God of the Bible, who's watching everything you do and keeping a list and checking it twice and making sure you're naughty or nice. But for most people, I think the concept of God has a kind of more poetic, metaphoric, abstract notion. But yeah, a majority of Americans definitely believe in God, no question about it.
You talked about a continuum or a spectrum within the secular, and I want to come back to one of those terms because you mentioned atheists and agnostics, but apatheists, they just don't care?
They're just not thinking about it. You know, this is really interesting because it's like I say to my students, you know, who is more secular? A group of atheists and agnostics who meet in a, you know, at a coffee shop once a week to discuss church state separation or a group of people who meet once a week for a pickup soccer game. Now, if you think about it, the pickup soccer game is actually a religion. It's not, religion's just not on the table. The atheists and agnostics and free thinkers who meet once a week, they're still talking about religion. They still care about religion. They're still mulling over it, picking it apart, debunking it, you know, but it's part of the conversation. Apatheist is a term we use to say someone who just doesn't care enough about the God question to even have an identity around it or an opinion about it. And so that indifference, I think, actually characterizes a lot of secular culture that we don't talk about. People who just aren't thinking about religious questions. It's just not a big part of their daily lives. And that's very pronounced in certain societies like Scandinavia. But I think it's also pronounced, you know, if I think about your average college student where I work, some are atheists. And to be an agnostic means you have to really have thought about the question enough to come up with that, oh, I guess I'm agnostic. But most of them, I say, are just apatheistic. They're just indifferent, don't really care, could care less about the whole question. And it bores them and they find it tedious and they don't really care.
Phil Zuckerman's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about secular versus religious morality. And in fact, his speaking engagement tonight is secular versus religious morality in the age of Trump. So who are the people who most feel that you need to have God or at least a belief in God to be moral? I mean, I can't imagine that the secular people agonize over it much, or they wouldn't be so secular.
No, but that's correct. In fact, your average secular person knows that you don't need God in order to be moral. They might even take it a step further and say, if there's a God, we can't be moral. And that's a whole philosophical discussion that goes back to Plato's dialogue with Socrates and Euthyphro, which we can get into. What it seems as though your average American, when asked on survey after survey after survey, there's high levels of distrust when people are asked about atheists. You know, when people are asked, you know, would you vote for such and such a person for president? And they're given a whole list of different demographics, you know, racial minorities, religious minorities. Atheists always often come in last. Would you want someone to marry your son or daughter? Atheists always come in last. And as social psychologists probe this even more, they find out that it's linked to immorality. Your average American thinks that you need to believe in God in order to be moral. And I'll give you an anecdote that kind of captures it if I have the time.
Sure.
I was invited to a debate at a mega church outside of Sacramento a couple years ago. Very interesting experience. It's actually on YouTube if you want to look it up. In the lobby afterwards, all the church members tried, you know, they were all witnessing to me, trying to tell me how great Jesus was and how wonderful he is and that I should really have a relationship with him. But one guy came up to me and he said, listen, you're a fine young man, blah, blah, blah. But you have to understand, let me tell you, I love women. And the only thing that keeps me from raping every woman I see is that I know God is watching. So there you go. God is what keeps me moral. And I mean, you know, this guy's effectively admitting that he's a sociopath, an amoral, violent man. But the only thing that keeps him from doing these things is God is watching. So what you have is a very childlike understanding of morality, that there's this magic being in the sky who's going to reward you if you obey his commands and punish you if you don't. And people think that this is what actually keeps them moral. It's not. Morality is not based on reward and punishment of a magical being. But I would say the majority of Americans understand their morality that way, and it's a problem, and it's not good.
Which raises a question that kind of bumped around in my mind when I was prepping for this visit, was the idea of sin versus bad behavior, whether the line for those who do have religion or a belief in God is harder, sharper, wider. When it is identified as sin, is it more of an uncrossable line?
Yeah, because that notion of sin captures some kind of, you've done some kind of cosmic misdeed, which has sort of rent your relationship with the creator of all. It has this kind of magical, mystical quality. And what I would say is, you know, for secular people, also sin, you know, is this kind of laundry list of do's and don'ts that often has nothing to do with harming another person. You know, for secular people, morality is pretty basic. Don't harm others. Help when you can. Treat people the way you would like to be treated. No magic there. No reward, no punishment. Basic, rational, empathetic orientations to the world. Help those that you can. Don't harm others. And treat people the way you would like to be treated. But sin is almost like this laundry list of, like I said, do's and don'ts. So, for example, if I may, you could talk about masturbation. A lot of people raised in a religious context will think that this is some sin. It's not. You're not harming anybody. You're not creating any pain or suffering. And there's no reason to see it as a cosmic evil. And yet, many religious people have been trained and brainwashed to think this, to their own pain and suffering, actually. I mean, what a sad state to be in. So what I find is that religious people, again, they have these laundry lists about, you know, can you do this? Can you do that? And it's moral outsourcing, because what they're not thinking about it for themselves. They're thinking, well, what does God tell me I can or can't do? What does the priest tell me I can or can't do? What does my minister tell me I can or can't do? And can I follow these rules? And if I don't, oh my gosh, I've committed this cosmic rent in the universe. Secular people don't have to deal with any of that. And in a sense, it is quite childish.
Phil Zuckerman created the country's first secular studies program at a college, at Pitzer College, where he is a professor of sociology in Southern California. He is speaking in Ashland tonight about secular versus religious morality in the age of Trump, 7 o'clock at the Rogue Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Ashland. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Gene and Winston. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Phil Zuckerman.
Oh, hello. Am I on the line?
Yes, you are. You're on the air.
Yes. Well, looking throughout history, which belief system do you think would win the atrocity award?
For being the most violent religion?
Well, I don't know. There's different ways you could look at it. I mean, number of people killed, the extent of the torture. I mean, there's a lot of different criteria that could be used, and I haven't really thought this through, but I thought maybe you might have some ideas on that.
Interesting question. Let's find out. Thanks, Gene.
Yeah, that's a biggie. That's a tough one, and I would have to defer to my historian colleagues here. But off the top of my head, I would say that, you know, there's been secular movements that have committed atrocities. You know, Stalin's Soviet Union tortured and killed tens of hundreds of millions. Pol Pot in Cambodia. You know, there's no – I wouldn't say that religion has a monopoly on causing pain and suffering. I think tribalism, nationalism, there are many secular versions of it as well. But if I had to step back, I would say, you know, there's a long bloody history within Christianity. There's a lot of pain and suffering. suffering caused in the Islamic world. There's a lot of pain and suffering fighting between among Hindus and so on and so forth. Buddhists seem to have a pretty good record. There are some violent leaning Buddhists here and there. For example, right now in Myanmar, they're persecuting Muslims there. But I would say Buddhism would be a top contender for me in terms of a worldview that has not caused too much in the way of pain and suffering. And then, you know, secular humanism has never dominated a government or dominated a society, but I do believe that secular humanism has a pretty good track record so far. I would say that people who major in philosophy tend to be fairly peaceful.
Well, I was reading your Psychology Today blog about God has nothing to do with morality. There's a very interesting twist there. The conversation that you portray in modern America actually might have taken place in ancient Greece. Explain that.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Is that the Euthyphro dilemma, I guess?
Mm-hmm.
Is that, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, this is a lovely dialogue from about 2,300 years ago. Let's see if I can sum it up as quickly as possible. It was written by Plato, and it involves Socrates, who's been called in basically to the DA's office. He's gotten into some trouble, and he's eventually going to be sentenced to death for it. But while he's waiting some pre-trial deliberations or whatnot, he meets another guy who's there at the DA's office, Euthyphro. And he says, well, why are you here, Euthyphro? And Euthyphro says, well, I'm here to turn in and give information about a murderer. And Socrates says, well, who's that? He said, oh, my father. And Socrates said, what? You're here to turn in your father? Yes, my father had some workers. The workers did some things wrong. He put one of the workers in a pit and went to the authorities in Delphi, and while he was there, there was some bad weather, and the worker died. So the worker died under my father's care, so my father needs to be brought to justice. And Socrates says, wow, that's heavy. I mean, it's your dad. He didn't really mean to kill the worker, but, you know, and Euthyphro's like, nope, that's what, you know, right is right, wrong is wrong. You got to do what you got to do. So Socrates asks him the question. So, well, you seem to know a lot about morality and piety. I mean, what is moral? And Euthyphro simply says, well, moral is what the gods will. What God says, that's what's moral. And the nub of the question then is, well, does God will it because it's moral, or does it become moral when God wills it? And both of those possibilities really thwart the notion that really cause problems. So if it's moral, and then God sees that it's moral and then commands it, that means morality exists outside of God. God's just observing it. If it only becomes moral once God commands it, that means morality is arbitrary, has something to do with harm or suffering. It's just the will of God. So God could command us to kill children, and that would thus be moral by fiat, which God does, by the way, in the Old Testament, commands us to kill children. So it's just one of those conundrums that's been plaguing us for centuries.
Well, and then I was about to ask you about that very thing, because you have said that the God worshipped in the West orders cruelty.
Yeah, this is what I can never understand. You know, whenever Jehovah's Witnesses come to my door, obviously they're usually often nice, sweet old ladies, so I just say thank you very much for the magazine. But if they're not nice, sweet old ladies, I say, well, why do you worship God that kills so many children? And they look at you dumbfounded. Like, what do you mean? They go, God doesn't kill children. I said, well, haven't you read your Bible? I mean, let's just start with the flood. How many children were drowned in the big flood? And there's many of the Midianites, the Amalites, there are so many times when God actively commands slaughter and torture of innocence. And, you know, you don't have to believe in that God. You can believe in a God that doesn't do that. But if you believe in the Bible, which most people who claim morality is based on God do, God commits all kinds of atrocities and commands all kinds of atrocities. So I can never understand how they square that. I mean, there's a long list of times that God tells people to kill children, to attack and slaughter. God commands genocide. I mean, it was so, you know, anyway, well, don't get me started.
I think we did already. We have, let's see, an email here from Rebecca, no town given. She says, my thoughts exactly. I've often wondered if being religious mostly starts in childhood in order to get the deep emotional connection. I was raised without religion, and many of my secular friends were too. We just don't get it, which brings us to another conversation you write about in your own life, the woman in Living the Secular Life who said she didn't want her kids to be nothing.
Yeah, indeed. So thanks for that email. She can wonder no more. If we know anything, it's that religion is a result of socialization in the home. We have so much data on this from sociologists, psychologists, anthropologists. The real engine of religiosity is children getting socialized into it by their parents and loved ones. There's just no debate on that anymore. So yes, If you are raised by people who are religious, they will inculcate that religion to you. And what kid would not take it? I mean, these are your caregivers. These are the ones who feed you and love you. If they tell you there's a magic leprechaun living under the house that requires you deposit corn nuts every morning, you're going to do that. I mean, who's going to think that these people are lying? So there's no question that religion is a result of being raised in it for 99% of the time. That said, the woman. So what happens in our culture in the United States, though, is being a good American is seen as to be religious as part of that experience. You go to this church, you go to that church, you go to this congregation. It's part of our social identity. It's part of our Americanness. And I ran into a mom a couple of years ago, as you mentioned, and she stopped me in the hallway. She knew about my work, and she said, "Boy, you know, I'm just not religious, but my kids are coming home now and saying, Mommy, you know, what are we? You know, Joey's a Baptist, you know, Skip is Jewish. What are we?" And she didn't know how to answer that. And she felt bad saying, "Well, we're nothing," because who wants to tell their children they're nothings, you know? And I said to her, "Well, tell them you're secular humanists." And she scratched her head and said, "What's that?" So we clearly have a branding problem, but we're hoping to fix that.
Well, is it so much a choice made as a choice never made? I mean, you don't.
That's right. That's right. I mean, it's. I think because people see religion as something and secularity as nothing, there's a problem. But actually, she's raising her children to be good, ethical, productive, happy, content beings, thoughtful. She's educating them well. She's just not taking them to church. And she needs to have some kind of language to explain that to them.
Back with Phil Zuckerman and Secular versus Religious Morality on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're having a discussion of secular versus religious morality because it's always a hot topic in America and a country that professes to have a great belief in God, but then church attendance isn't as high as that belief in God would indicate. But you can obviously find God outside of church. Phil Zuckerman finds morality outside of God, and he talks about it a lot. He is a professor of sociology at Pitzer College, the founding chair there of the nation's first secular studies program. He'll be speaking tonight in Ashland at the Rogue Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship at 7 p.m. The talk is called Secular versus Religious Morality in the Age of Trump. This is a conversation you can join right here, right now at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Dan and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Phil Zuckerman.
Oh, good morning, Phil. I think we grew up in the same neighborhood. I went to University High School.
Okay, my mom went there. I was at Pali, but my mom was at uni.
Oh, well, you see, Pali didn't exist, but it was a great school, and all I can say is Nancy got her dad, Frank, to sing at our prom.
Wow.
Those were the days.
Wow.
Here, I know you've read Eric Hoffer's The True Believer, but I think it should be required reading for a book, for a class like yours, for a course like yours. Wouldn't you agree?
I would not agree because he has no data.
Gosh, he's got a lot of references there. Just because he's a longshoreman, you know, he's not illiterate. But
yeah,
you know, I think you can't be afraid to see what you see. And I'm my people came over here so they could interpret things for themselves rather than listen to the Church of England. And you know, I think you're right to ask the question. But my grandniece, who's a Muslim, referred to the Quran, and she said, you know, a good question is the beginning of education. Your question is good, but, you know, when you settle on believing things like secularism, you know, you obviously haven't ignored all the rest of the things and all the evil. That book by the rabbi on why bad things happen to good people, I think, is a good reference, too, to answer the question of evil in the world. You know, it's amazing. I'd like to. Do you have a book we could read?
I would recommend Living the Secular Life, if I can toot my own horn there, where I try to talk about how you can be moral and ethical from a secular perspective, and that you don't need God or religion to live a good, ethical, moral life. Living the Secular Life.
Dan, thanks.
I don't know. I got a lot out of Ecclesiastes, for example.
Ooh, that's my favorite book of the Bible, hands down.
Well, then you should go see my old Occidental roommate Terry Gilliam's movie, The Infinity Theorem. It's about Koheleth,
okay,
the writer of it, and I think there's so much wisdom there. Then
I agree. But it comes from that wisdom comes from the human brain. Nothing magical. It's just a brilliant human articulating what it means to be alive.
Dan, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. So, I wanted to pull up something here from Living the Secular Life, where you write that being secular is about finding joy, splendor, and fulfillment in newborn babies and thunderstorms, peaches and tears, harmony and inner thighs, algebra and forgiveness, squid and irony, without attaching any supernatural or divine masking tape to such inexplicable wonders of life.
Hey, someone got my inner thighs quote. Thank you.
Oh man, that's amazing. So, but some interesting thing, algebra and forgiveness. But masking tape. It's interesting. So do religious people then? Are they masking things off so they can't see them? Are they denying some things that should be in front of them in order to maintain religion?
I think what I was trying to capture in that passage is like, yeah, life is full of wonder. Life is full of mystery. Life is full of amazing, joyous, beautiful, psychedelic things. What we don't need to then do there is add some by masking tape, I meant like, oh, and now we're going to call this God, or we're going to call this the wonders of Jesus, or we're going to call – to me – that does nothing but actually reduce the awe, reduce the mystery, reduce the wonder. It's kind of like when the Mormons come knocking on your door and they say, you know, let me tell you about the meaning of life and the universe. And they have this little book with pictures and cartoons. You know, God, here is God. He has a plan. And then they turn the page. On this day, God created the world. You know, it's almost like, wah, 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 wah. Really? This is it? This is what you think? All this mystery, all this wonder, all this awe, you're going to reduce to a little cartoon book? So I guess what I was trying to say is the world is mind-blowingly incredible. We don't need religion's papier-mâché to explain it, to define it, to give it meaning, to give it beauty. If anything, I would argue the stories the religion tells take away from the majesty of existence, not add to it.
I wonder, too, if part of the reason we see fewer people admitting to a belief in God comes from people feeling more comfortable in making that very admission.
Absolutely. Not only has it been illegal to declare your lack of belief in God for many, many centuries. It could get you imprisoned. It could get you tortured. It could get you killed. In about something like 13 countries today, it still can get you the death penalty if you come out as a non-believer. So not only has it been legally dangerous, quite literally, but it's also been a social stigma. I mean, if you came out, I'm reading a book right now about Ernestine Rose, an early feminist, abolitionist, and atheist from the 1800s. And I mean, the fact that she was a non-believer was such a scandal. Wherever she spoke, people didn't want to be on the stage with her. People didn't want to have anything to do with her because that she was tarred and feathered as an infidel. But now, just like I have to say, at least a little bit like the gay rights movement, gay and lesbians, who had to finally come out and break, shatter that stigma, which resulted in tremendous gains in social acceptance, legal and social and otherwise, I think what you're finding is a lot of secular people in the last 25 years have more and more felt comfortable coming out, as it were, to use that metaphor, as being non-religious. And as more people do that, more people also feel comfortable doing that. And it's starting to have a ripple effect.
So where the previous call, Dan and Eugene, was talking about him embracing religion and being quite comfortable with that, we have kind of the opposite view from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley, who writes, first of all, what is not discussed generally is the difference between religion and spirituality. That's one thought to hold on to. The first question is, how does secularism connect to spirituality, spirituality being defined as a responsible relationship with everything? Second, the claim that without a rule book, i.e. religion, people cannot be compassionate, moral, or ethical, assumes human beings to be innately bad. And more importantly, religion appropriates the authority to define ethics and morals, and from there it is only one step to redefining them to allow those in power to suit themselves and enslave everybody else. That again from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley.
I wish I had written that. He's spot on. I love it. I agree with everything.
So the religion versus spirituality part, that's a good thing to bring up here, though, because whereas secularism is not just the absence of religion, I mean, it can contain spirituality, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, spirituality is just such a nebulous concept. I've heard it defined so many different ways. Was it Wolfgang? I love that. Having a responsible relationship with everything? Wow, amen to that. If that's what being spiritual is, I'm the high priest of attempting to be spiritual. I obviously fall short, as we all do. I've heard So what I would say is, spirituality is kind of another realm where it's people who saying, you know, I have a relationship with something deeper, bigger, non-empirical. I just don't see it as a religion, and I'm not part of a religious community, and I don't follow certain religious dogmas or tenets or whatnot. And amen to that, if that's what float people's boat. But what I would say is, if it involves supernatural thinking, magical thinking, so, okay, maybe you don't believe in God of the Old Testament, but you believe these crystals, you know, can cure your testicular cancer, then you are, I think, not quite secular on that level. However, most spiritual people, I would argue, tend to be more open to secular culture, certainly church-state separation. They don't like the government being involved with religion and vice versa. So that's another conversation. But so on those three B's, I would say spiritual people are usually not religious in the belonging sense. They're not religious. They might be religious in the behavior sense, but they are religious in the belief sense if they believe in something otherworldly, unempirical. If it's just being responsible to everything in the world, well, then that's a secular orientation, to be sure.
All right, so let us build on the secular orientation and not just define it as not being religious. I mean, what are some of the pillars of secular community and society?
Yeah. I would say, number one, an ethics that is based on empathy. So being moved by the suffering of others, being happy by the joy in others, and treating people the way you want to be treated. That's a primary pillar. Number two, critical thinking, I think, is a huge pillar of secular culture. Understanding how skepticism works, doubt, demanding evidence, you know, accepting claims based on their evidentiary merit, and requiring some kind of evidence and proof for that. So you got your empathy, you've got your critical thinking, and a desire for evidence-based claims. I would say also a love of and appreciation of the natural world is a huge pillar of secular culture. Appreciating that we live in a natural world and all that that means, and in terms of duties and joys and pleasures. I would say another big pillar of secular culture is thinking for oneself, individualism. These are traits that you'll find abundant in secular culture. I also think there is a real, how can I say this? A sense that this is all there is. A here and now-ness is what I would call it. This is it. This life, this time, this planet, there is nothing else. There's no afterlife, there's no pre-life, and there's no gods or gurus who are going to save us. So a humanism defined as a belief in the ability of humans to do good and be good and make the world a better place.
When you get to the critical thinking part, I'm not just trying to be a pain in the neck here, but I wonder if anybody ever got to a point where they began to think very deeply about their own beliefs, got to critical thinking about their own thinking, and decided, you know what, I really need to believe in God.
And to those people, I have no beef. I mean, I really don't care if people believe in God and it provides meaning in their lives, makes them a better person, gets them through the night. That's fine by me. And yes, I think there's a lot of brilliant, thoughtful people, reflective people who have come to believe in God. And good for them if that works. My only problem is if then their God tells them that I can't marry who I want to meet, or if their God tells them we can't engage in stem cell research, or if their God tells them global warming was a myth invented by the Chinese. I mean, hey, as long as that God is just a personal source of comfort or meaning, I have no problem. It's only when that God starts affecting how society runs and what I can or can't do with myself or my children, then we have a problem. But barring that, I'm fine with God belief.
Let's see if we can get some more calls in here before the end. Mary in Springfield, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Phil Zuckerman.
Thank you. I wanted to ask Mr. Zuckerman what books you read. I wonder if you've read any of the current biblical scholars' work.
Yeah, let's see. I read kind of everything, and I mean, I don't know where to start there. I read a lot of mostly nonfiction, but I try to read fiction every now and then to keep me human. A biblical scholar, sure. I've read, Bart Ehrman's work. I've read, who did I used to read a lot of? This was something about 5 or 10 years ago. I read a lot of biblical scholarship. I find that I really love the debates over the historical Jesus. I've read all of that stuff. I've read, you know, who wrote the New Testament, who wrote the Bible. I've read all that. I don't know about everything, but it's fun. It's interesting. And everything I read just illustrates that the Bible was clearly written by humans, clearly written by people. There's so much evidence pointing in that direction, and there's zero evidence pointing in the direction that it came from a magical, invisible being.
Another email question here from Shoshana in Ashland writes, I remember reading that Carl Jung said something like, in 400 years, religion would no longer exist. Are you familiar with that statement? And if so, or even if not, what would that mean to you? Great program. Thank you, says Shoshana.
I'm not familiar with that quote. I'm not sure what he's getting at or what he means, because religion gets defined in so many different ways. Does he mean religious belief? Does he mean religious belonging, behaviors, congregating, singing hymns, celebrating Christmas? It's just so all over the place. What I would say is there's good religion and bad religion. There's religion that creates community, causes people to do good things, sing nice songs, eat good food, have wonderful traditions and rituals. I would not like to see those things gone in 400 years. I think they're quite lovely and beautiful, and I have enjoyed them throughout my life. Then there's the bad religion, which causes people a lot of pain, suffering, guilt, worry, anxiety, and causes all kinds of problems in the world. That type of religion I would love to see gone 400 years ago, not just 400 years in the future. So that's what I would say to Dr. Jung.
Down to our last minute, basically, here. And I noticed that that in your writings that you talk about religious people really don't trust atheists. Polls show that over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Absolutely. What's going on there?
Uh-huh.
Projection. Yeah. If your morality is based on an invisible deity telling you what you can and can't do, that's moral outsourcing. You're not taking responsibility for your own choices and actions. You're not reflecting on your own conscience. You're just looking for some outside authority to tell you what to do and how to be. If that is your basis of morality, then you think someone who doesn't have that God can't be moral, when in fact it is the God-based morality that is problematic. So I think this, if I had to give one thing, it's a case of projection here.
Phil Zuckerman is a professor of sociology at Pitzer College, founding chair of the first secular studies program in the country, blogs for Psychology Today and the Huffington Post, is the author of many books, including Living the Secular Life. He speaks tonight at 7 at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Ashland on secular versus religious morality in the age of Trump, brought in by the Jefferson Center, no relation to Jefferson Public Radio, but they bring in great guests. Thanks so much for that. And Phil Zuckerman, thank you for joining us today in the exchange once again.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much.